The following podcast contains explicit language.
Listen, if you want, we can enroll you in the intensive weekend classes too. It's an additional cost, but I think it's really worth it here.
You can't afford that.
It's an investment in your future, David. It's important for your parents
and your... You don't understand.
Look, I've done this for 10 years. I've counseled over 1,000 students. I think I understand.
No, you don't. You just don't.
Yeah. 대학도 졸업 못하면 인생 어떻게 살라 그래?
Hey, welcome back to Represent. I'm Aisha Harris, your host, as always. And that clip you heard at the top of the show is from Spotnight. And I'm excited to bring to you today a very fascinating conversation with Josa, the star of Spotnight. And I'm really excited to let you all hear the conversation. It went in a very interesting direction. So it'll be very fun. But first, we have Alex Jung from New York Mag joining us again today.
Yay!
Yay. And actually, Alex, I think you mentioned it as your plus in your last episode, the movie Spotnight.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
And I don't remember what you said, but you raved about it. And or am I projecting? You didn't rave about it, but you...
I liked it.
Okay.
Yeah. I almost feel bad saying that in some ways sometimes.
You don't have to like everything.
Right. Well, no.
Or love everything.
Right. Love everything.
Yes.
I thought what I really liked about it was that it felt like it came from this very familiar and specific place. Like it felt like L.A. Koreatown.
Yeah.
And it felt like a story about a very specific person in that world. Mm. And the things that I sort of didn't like so much about it was what I felt were more tonal of it. It did feel very bleak to me as a film.
Mm, yeah.
Sometimes watching it, I wanted him to have a friend.
Yeah, he was very lonely in that movie.
Right. It's a movie that I think is very much driven by a feeling of alienation and isolation.
Mm-hmm. But I definitely think it's worth watching. And,
oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the actor, Joe, he's a very fascinating guy. And we had a really fun conversation.
So. And also, like, just him as an actor, from what I understand, he had to go to Korea to do work, right? To find work as an actor, which is, you know, lucky for him in the sense that he's bilingual and he could do that. But
right.
At the same time, sad that he needs to go to another country to find work, even though he's American.
Yeah, we get into that too. But yeah, so today you and I are going to talk about Transparent, season 3.
Right.
Which...
A coming-of-age story of its own in some ways.
Yes, yes. And Transparent, for those who aren't totally familiar, this is a show on Amazon. I think it might actually be the first Amazon show that has... It sort of broke the mold and put Amazon on the map in mm-hmm. terms of not just, you know, a big box company or place where you buy your, you know, clothes or toothbrushes or whatever. It made them a viable player in the world of Netflix and Hulu.
Totally.
And
got them those Emmys.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah,
and well, I mean, we could jumpstart with that where the Emmys were last week and Jeffrey Tambor, the star of the show, he mm-hmm. plays Mora mm-hmm. and he's on Transparent. He plays, I don't remember what his original, his like male name on the show was.
Mort.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yes. His name was Mort. And he is transitioning to become Mora. And
although Mora would say Mora was always Mora.
True.
Right.
Thank you for that correction. Yes. Mora was always Mora. Mora is just coming to the forefront. And I don't know if we love Mora as a viewer. That's the thing about the show is that all of the characters, for the most part, are just very difficult to like,
yes.
I think, as people.
Yes. Especially the kids.
Especially the kids. But I digress. Jeffrey Tambor won for playing Mora. And he gave a really, I think, in many ways, great speech about how he wishes that there were more opportunities for trans actors to actually play these roles.
Right.
And I'm paraphrasing, but he said along the lines of, like, if I was the last cisgender person to play a trans person, I would not be upset about that.
Right.
What did you think about that?
I think he's right, right? Like, I think in an ideal world, that is what would happen. That is not what's going to happen,
no.
Sadly, as more films are being greenlit or in production or whatever with cis actors playing trans characters. you know, Transparent is in a really unique moment in the sense that I think it helped this conversation of trans people in media and pop culture and television shows and film and things like that as part of the more of a mainstream conversation. And at the same time, it's finding itself having to stay ahead of the curve in some ways.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult thing to do when you've built a show around a cis actor to play a trans character. And so I think that they understand that that in and of itself is a sort of contradiction and difficulty. But we also, you know, like, I think to be fair, I have to remember that this is 3 years, like 2 or 3 years that this has sort of shifted very radically. And that's not to like necessarily give them a pass. Mm-hmm. But I do think that at least from what I can tell with Jill and Jeffrey.
And by Jill, you mean Jill Soloway, the creator.
Yeah, Jill Soloway, the creator, and Jeffrey Tambor, the actor. They seem to understand that this is no longer tenable.
Right. Well, let's dive in a bit into the first episode, which I think kind of speaks to that aspect, mm-hmm. although not necessarily from the side of a cis actor playing a trans person, but wanting to address the criticisms that have been laid at the show's feet for not being as inclusive when it comes to race and class. And I'm curious what you think about it.
Uh-huh. I'm also curious to hear what you think about
it. Well, okay. So the way I feel about that is sort of the way I felt about Girls, which is that this is their world.
Right.
Like, so right. And these people exist in a bubble.
Right.
And so to me, it's realistic for them not to have much interaction with people of different classes, of different races. That's just, they're very insular, and that's the way it is.
Right.
And I think with Girls, obviously, Lena Dunham, I think maybe because it was 2012 and we were, it was a different, sort of different time, but Lena Dunham got way more flack for it than I think Jill Soloway has done. Like, I feel like there's not as much loud criticism about the way Transparent has addressed it as there was for Girls.
Right.
That being said, the way Lena Dunham tried to fix it was like, let me give myself a black boyfriend in season two for a few episodes, played by Donald Glover.
Right.
And then it just kind of receded to the background.
Right.
And in this season, I feel, at least in the first episode, it's way more integrated in a, I don't know if natural is the right word, but in a more believable way than it was on Girls.
I would agree with that. I mean, so to recap, in the first episode at least, Maura is working for what I can tell as far as like a queer youth hotline kind of thing.
Yeah, sort of a hotline. I don't know if it's a crisis hotline per se, but I'm sure a lot of people who call in have like emergency crises.
Right. And I think, you know, I think that does feel like a natural way of allowing Maura to interface with people that are of different backgrounds than her. My problem, I guess, mm-hmm. with it is, like, I agree with you. Like, I don't think that, like, I sort of, the show is what it is, right? Like, to me, it makes sense that this rich Jewish family wouldn't really interact with poor people or people of color.
Right.
Like, that seems real to me. And so I think, trying to force conversations of race into that would then, in some ways, be uncomfortable or feel artificial.
Mm.
I think the first episode did a good job in terms of making it feel real and natural because you see Maura try to track down someone who called her.
And her name is Eliza, and she's a trans black woman who calls. Maura picks up, and Maura says all the wrong things to her, and she's flustered, and then she tries to connect with her by saying, I'm trans. Like, I think Eliza calls her sir or something, or mister.
Right.
And she says, well, actually, I'm trans. Right. And Eliza says, oh, I am too. But then because Maura says all the wrong things, Eliza eventually just winds up hanging up. But she does get a kernel of information of where she might be.
Right.
So this leads Maura on a journey to try to find her and track her down and try to help her.
Right.
And she winds up in like a SWAT, like
a SWAT meet. Yeah.
Which is in like South LA, which is where most people of color are. I did like a moment when Maura is there in the swap meet and she finds some trans women, some mm-hmm. trans Latina women. Mm-hmm. And at first, the conversation goes really well. She's mm-hmm. just like, I'm trans too. She's speaking in like sort of broken Spanish.
Right.
And they're like very receptive. Right. And she asks them if they've seen a girl with green hair because Eliza has green hair. But then it goes south as soon as she says, have you seen her in the streets?
Right.
And they're like, well, actually, I'm in nursing school. These two girls are like whatever.
Right.
And I was based on the way these things sometimes go, I was expecting that conversation to sort of reaffirm Maura as like a sympathetic, not that she's a sympathetic character usually, but to sort of make it seem as though, oh, at least she's trying.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no, like, the Latina trans people, like, they don't give her any leeway. They're like,
they didn't give her a pass.
Not at all.
And the last look that they give her was so good.
It was so good. And I appreciated that because it was like, we're not letting up on you. We're not going to give you that pass. And I liked that moment. And I think in a way it puts her in this position, Maura in a position of she's still trying to work things out. And mm-hmm. she still has all of these advantageous aspects to
right,
her.
Right.
Did you see any parallel to her? I see parallel to her in Caitlyn Jenner. Like, it's so obvious. And Caitlyn Jenner even makes an appearance in a later episode.
Yeah.
I think as herself. I couldn't tell.
Yeah. As herself in a hazy dream state.
Yeah.
Like a drug-induced state.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I like the episode, is that I don't feel as though the show gives Maura a pass and sort of shows how trans experiences can be very, very different when intersected with other things like class and race. And I liked that Maura doesn't save her in the end, right? Like, Maura finds and tracks down Eliza, but she isn't the one who saves her. Eliza is in some ways maybe the one who saves her.
Right.
Because she is the one who corrects other people that she is female. And then that's when she faints and then has to be taken to the hospital. And so, like, I appreciated those moves where you didn't necessarily have a white savior
mm-hmm.
saving someone. You had a white savior who was trying to be a white savior and fucked it up.
Yeah. Yes.
But then my problem with this whole conversation is that then you drop it. Like, the show drops this entire sort of meditation on white fragility. It sort of calls out to the phrase white fragility in when Allie is TAing a class with other TAs and she talks about it and someone brings up the idea of white fragility.
Yeah.
So it's very much clearly on their minds, but it thematically it just disappears after the premiere, which is what I find disappointing, because if you're going to deal with it and have a conversation about it, then it should be something more than a one-off episode.
And that's the problem that you often face when I think a creator tries to directly address mm-hmm. critics mm-hmm. is that they do it for like one episode
right.
or maybe two, and
right.
then it just goes away. And it's the same thing that happened with Girls.
Right.
Granted, you could say I did start to see in general more people of color just in the background mm-hmm. of Transparent than I did before.
Mm-hmm.
In that scene with the right fragility, there's Nicole Byer, the comedian, mm-hmm. is in that episode. And there's a few other people sprinkled out. And there's also the rabbi. Is
right.
it rabbi?
Rabbi Raquel's love interest, new
yes.
love interest. That's not Josh.
Yeah.
Who is my assumption, and I don't think this is actually explained, is that he's a mixed race Jewish rabbi also.
Right.
Or a cantor, rather.
Yes.
And again, that's great, right? I like love that that is being brought into the conversation. But again, my problem with that was that it is not actually addressed in any substantive way during the series, at least this season.
So you think that like the fact that he is mixed race should be addressed in some way, or?
I don't know. I mean, I guess like that's an interesting question. Guess I feel like it's a slightly missed opportunity because you don't talk about Jewish people who are not white ever.
True. And the right? show like, is very much about the Jewish culture, but it.
Right.
It does feel very even insular in that
right.
sense.
Like, it feels very Ashkenazi Jew.
Yes. Yeah.
It and you know, there are Jewish people who are Asian American.
Yeah.
You know, there are Black Jews.
Yes.
And but that you know, that like, and so if you bring an actor who is of that or who is playing a character of that background, that's an interesting thing to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Rather than just leave alone. But you know, like
even
all right.
even if it was just like a offhand remark that
sure.
someone makes about it.
Right.
Whether it's offensive or not offensive or just like, yes, he is a person of color and there are no other, like barely any other people of color in the synagogue. So, yes.
I'm not saying we need to have a very special episode about it.
Right.
But something.
It's
maybe.
It's about acknowledging, because that's the thing, like, right? We don't want people to be colorblind. Like we want people to acknowledge our differences.
Right.
And, you know, that I agree. Now that I think about it, it does feel like a missed opportunity.
Right. Well, and I guess just in context of the first episode too, where I feel like they sort of drop the race stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's where I start to feel a little skeptical of what's going on.
Right.
Of like wanting to have a conversation about race or saying that you're open to doing that, but then not really committing to it.
Right. Do we want to shift a bit to talking about Maura's transition in general? Because in this season, she is going even further in terms of her exploration of like what she wants and how she wants to live her life. And in one of the earlier episodes, she announces to her family and also her chosen family, which includes her girlfriend, Vicky, played by Angelica Houston.
Right.
She announces that I don't want to be called Mappa anymore.
Right.
I'm planning to get full surgery and also get my face done. And like the way the show's been progressing, it feels like something that I'm not surprised is happening. You've seen more of the show than I have at this point. I've watched half of it. I've watched the first five episodes and I haven't seen the last 10 yet.
Bad.
But I know.
Like there's too much TV.
There's just too much freaking TV.
And the expectation to just sort of watch all of it at once is a lot.
I commend you for watching all of it at once.
Well, you know, it's for the job.
True. I mean, this is my job too, but I. But I'm doing this on behalf of the
it
folks.
It hasn't even been a week.
It hasn't. You know? It hasn't. And I'm doing this on behalf of the folks who, like me, don't have time, even when it is my job to watch every single thing.
Right.
But so, how do you see that progression? Is the idea, because there is a moment when I believe Vicky or another character says, you know, if you want to get all this done, then you are sort of giving into these rigid ideas of what gender is, or it says that you don't love yourself as you are. Do you think the show handles that struggle that she's having well or effectively?
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer that question necessarily. I do feel like I at least appreciate that conversation is being had, that it's not a given, right?
Yeah.
Like I think the narrative often in like mainstream pop culture is that this is the trajectory that a trans person is supposed to go through.
Right.
And that's actually not the case, where there's non-op trans people. There are people who, you know, like choose to go through gender confirmation surgery and facial feminization surgery and all of these things. But there's actually a wide array of ways of being trans too that doesn't necessarily have to follow a script, right? Like not everyone is going to like also be able to afford it.
Right.
So there's a lot of these, I think, layers to being trans that I hope are part of the conversation, which, you know, not to spoil the season for you, but like things get complicated with regard to Maura's desire to have surgery that I think will potentially set up and open the conversation for the next season into these questions of, you know, what does it perhaps mean to not have surgery and be a trans woman?
In a way, that's one thing I think Transparent is pretty good at least from my perspective, is asking those questions and then exploring them. I guess my only, to bring it back a bit to the idea of class, I guess my biggest issue with the show is never that it was a show in which they're all wealthy and in which they don't interact with people of color. I guess my biggest issue was like, for a while, it was the only show that really centered around it. And it always seems to be anytime we get into groundbreaking territory, it's with people of a higher class. Mm-hmm. Like even the Cosby Show, you think about mm-hmm. a show like that, like they had to be really wealthy and rich and well off mm-hmm. and not have to worry about money in order for things to push to right. push forward.
There are not many shows that deal with class actively, I think.
Yeah. I've never watched Shameless, but I've heard Shameless does right. a really good job of doing
also,
that.
Also, I think The Middle is supposed to do a fairly good job of, you know, at least doing a working class, yeah. middle class yeah. thing.
And The Wire, too, I think, was very good at that.
Right, right, right. You know, I do think to bring in one aspect, or I think one way in which the show has been successful in terms of bringing in different conversations that don't center around Maura's specific experience are characters like Shay, right, who they sort of pair off with Josh. Mm-hmm. I don't think you've seen it yet, but, like, she goes on a road trip with him to go deliver, spoiler alert, sorry, Rita's ashes to their son. It's there that, like, it's clear that there's a sexual relationship, I think, between them, or maybe a budding one. And she brings up things like that she's HIV positive, that if he would be interested in a relationship, that maybe he would explore PrEP. Like, these are, like, conversations that are very much a part of a lot of people's experiences in the trans community, but is not one that Maura is likely to have. And I think, like, that's an, you know, a useful example of, like, how people of different class backgrounds and races bring in, you know, more texture to the conversation of, like, mm-hmm. there are so many different ways of being and living and experiencing this thing that you sort of call trans.
Right.
Which is true for every part of the LGBT community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we could obviously talk about Transparent all day after I've seen the rest of the season, which will be soon, I'm sure. But yeah, I'm looking, if you guys have any thoughts about Transparent season 3 or even season 2 and 1, holler at us, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on what you think about the show and how it handles all these issues we've talked about. Moving on, we have our Plus Delta segment.
Plus Delta.
Yes. And I know you were sort of fretting over your Delta.
I was.
Prior to us recording.
Put me on blast.
I think it's actually a good, I think it'll be good.
Okay. Wait, are we starting with Deltas then?
You could start with whatever you'd like.
Oh, okay.
I'm probably going to start with a Delta because I try not to end the show end the segment on a negative note.
Okay, sure.
So,
yeah. I'm happy to start with a Delta.
All right.
And to explain to people listening what I was telling you before we started recording. The night after the debates, Will and Grace released like a short episode, I guess, like a 10-minute-ish episode that is the same characters, the same four characters, Will, Grace, Jack, and Karen, in, you know, Will's apartment, and they are in the present day. So they're talking about the election. And so it's a election-centered sketch or whatever episode. And Karen, of course, is a Trump supporter. She says lots of racist things. The comedy felt like it felt like it was the show from 10 years ago. Like,
right.
That's exactly what it felt like. And if you remember the show functioned on a certain kind of homophobia and racism. You know, like, Karen was funny because she was racist, right?
But very Archie Bunker.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's like a classic model that I think has clearly gotten outdated. And I think watching it in this context in the present day was that kind of wake-up call of, like, this is getting really antiquated, right? Like, they, like, make fun of Jack for not being a man again, right? Like,
what?
Right, which, if you remember the show, was stuff they did
all the time.
On the regular, right?
I do
because
remember
he
that,
was flamboyant,
yeah.
And so therefore not quite or not enough.
Yeah.
And I remember watching this on I got home late and I was like in my bed watching it on my phone. I was just like chortled, even though I knew that it was bad. Like in my head, I was like, like I winced when I like heard all the jokes again. But I guess like there was a nostalgia there that I was like, it's kind of funny.
It's like my experience of watching Sex and the City 10 years later.
Right, right. Right. Right, right. That's very generous of you. Thank you.
No, I can. I'm just saying I can relate.
Right. And so this is to say that, like, I remember I tweeted last night, like late last night after I had watched it, I just tweeted like this. I sort of enjoyed this ? Mm-hmm. And then I woke up in the morning with some people being like, that was kind of fucked up. And then I was, you know, and yeah. I thought about it and I was like, yeah, you're right. That was totally kind of fucked up. Like it really brings into relief the fact that this comedy just doesn't fly anymore.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's a good sign, right?
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah. I definitely think that you could say the same for so much of that era of television. And I think, yes, it's, yeah, it all of that sounds terrible. But at the same time, the fact that people don't think it's good is a good sign that we are maybe moving away from such, like, not even funny humor.
Yeah.
But on the more positive side, what is your plus?
So there's so the thing is, I'm actually having trouble picking one thing. I do think, I do just want to say the fall offering of TV is phenomenally good.
Yes, it is.
Just across the board, Insecure, Atlanta.
I just watched the first episode of Insecure.
It's so good.
So good.
It's so good.
I love Issa.
One Mississippi.
Tig Notaro's show, right?
Yeah. Tig Notaro's One Mississippi, Speechless, starring Minnie Driver. There's just a lot of really good shows that surprisingly don't focus on any straight white men. And guess what? So they're all really good.
And they're all also just very different, too.
Yeah.
The variety is great. It's not like TV is, or at least most networks are not producing the same sort of, we have this formula, now we're going to do it. We see with most things where it's Modern Family, now we have to have like every show like Modern Family.
Right.
We're seeing all these varieties of different characters and different themes and different ideas.
And I guess so I'm trying to pick one that I feel like is all out that someone can enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to shout out Fleabag, I guess, out of this group.
Oh, I have not even heard of that.
Right. And it's a little less like known. And I think that's the other reason I have. It's by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And she is an actor and comedian in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And it started off as a one woman play that she did in Edinburgh. A couple years ago, and she turned it into a TV show, and it's 6 episodes or so on Amazon.
Uh-huh.
And so you can just watch it now. It's a woman dealing with grief and loss. It's a comedy. and so she's also like incredibly in some way self-destructive. She's also considers herself this sexually voracious person, and it is just really good. She does this really interesting talking to the camera, breaking the fourth wall style that is the best I've ever seen it done. It doesn't annoy me like other shows, like in House of Cards, for instance. It's an excellent, excellent show. So I would highly recommend that as just if you're bored, watch that on the weekend.
I also like the fact that it's only 6 episodes.
Yes.
Which
it's
seems
so
easy.
Manageable.
Yeah, I recently got into Catastrophe, and that's also 6 episodes, and it was so easy to watch
because
6 episodes
exactly.
a season. Well, like I said, I'm going to start with my Delta because I don't like to end on sad notes all the time. although my Delta is not so much a you've got to do better Hollywood, it's more of a you've got to do better universe. So over the weekend, Bill Nunn, who is best known for creating Radio Raheem from Do the Right Thing, died. Mm. And it just really, considering all the things that are happening right now in the news and all of the unarmed black people who continue to get shot and we continue to watch it happen on video, and his death just feels in a way so poignant and sad. And he was obviously, he did lots of other things. He was in other Spike Lee movies. He was in like the Spider-Man movies, but he will forever, I think, be Radio Raheem.
Radio Raheem!
And what that means to cinema and to black people and black culture, it saddens me. And it just adds another person gone too soon from 2016.
Oh shit! Let me check it out. That's the hype!
Newest, latest. Let me tell you the story of right hand, left hand. It's a tale of good and evil. Hey, it was with this hand that Cain iced his brother. Love. These five fingers, they go straight to the soul of man.
On the more positive, happy side of the spectrum, as of this morning, Tuesday morning when we're recording this, the trailer for Fences dropped. And
I already watched it.
Yes. Yeah, Fences is the August Wilson play that people probably, if you know anything about August Wilson, they probably know that the best. And the trailer dropped. It's starring Denzel Washington and Viola Davis. They both won the Tony for this play when it came out on Broadway a few years ago. So I didn't get to see it. I'm sure a lot of people didn't get to see it.
Right.
And now that we have Denzel and Viola on screen doing this, and Denzel is directing.
Right.
Which is... what? Like, yeah. It just has all of these. And I know it, in a way it seems very Oscar baity, and they're releasing it in time for the Oscars.
Right. It's coming out on Christmas Day, I believe.
Of course it is.
It's a Christmas present.
Of course it is. So I'm just super excited about it. It uses a famous, pretty well known speech from the play to sort of illustrate, and there's all these images going on, and you see Viola crying in that, remember in Doubt when she has like all the snot, and you're just like, I want to wipe the snot. Well, we see more of that, and it's just great. And
she is fully committed to the snot.
She is so fully committed.
Which,
I love it.
That is real.
Yes. It's not like a tear.
No.
It's like, that's snot.
No, yeah, it's real crying. It's not pretty crying.
Yeah, she is excellent at just full on crying. And I'm just excited. I'm also really excited to see Denzel. I mean, I've written about this before and I talked about it, and Magnificent Seven, I must say, is actually a very enjoyable movie. It has its...
Wait, really?
Yeah, it has its... There, I have some issues with it, but overall, I think Magnificent Seven is just like a fun time at the movies, and it's great to see Denzel on a horse. But I also have worried about him getting too far into like old man action hero, and it's great to see him going back to something meatier and just... giving us all that Denzel that we've come to know and love. Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to have you on again,
Thanks
Alex.
For having me on.
And where can people find you and your work?
You can read my work on New York Magazine's Vulture.com or follow me on Twitter at @E_AlexJung.
All right. And now, let's jump into my conversation about Spotlight. Spotlight tells the story of David, a first-generation Korean-American living in L.A., who finds himself at a crossroads when his family's restaurant, where he's worked, is forced to go out of business. Does he please his parents by studying for the SATs and going on to college? Or does he figure out what he wants to do with his life on his own? Writer-director Andrew Ahn's film is a beautiful and contemplative movie about the child of immigrants' experience and gay male self-discovery. And I had the pleasure of talking with its star, Joe Suh, about digging into the role of David, being a working Asian-American actor, and much more. Check it out. Thank you so much for joining me today, Joe.
Absolutely. I'm excited to be here.
So in Spotlight, your character, David, you have spent most of your young adult life working in your parents' restaurants, and then suddenly your parents' restaurant goes out of business.
Right.
And so you have to figure out sort of what you want to do with your life and where to go from here.
Right.
I'm curious as to whether there were any parallels between your life and David's life. And if you can talk a little bit about your background.
Yeah, there are a lot of similarities. And I think this could, like, be a testament to, like, a lot of other, even, like, immigrant families. Mm-hmm. I grew up in L.A. most of my life, so that's almost... it's parallel to David. Mm-hmm. And I did help out at my parents' restaurant. They had a restaurant also, but it wasn't Korean.
Okay.
It was like a fusion of like just, it was just American food, like, you know, like a diner, almost like a burgers to like chorizo. Like growing up, everyone kind of works and kind of goes, like, we all have similar goals. So like, it's kind of like, okay, help out the family and then also work on your education aspect. And the education aspect, just as David, it was even more intense in my life, where they're like, I don't care if you don't help out anymore. Don't help out. with their family, just, you know, study. Studying is helping out for me. You know, like, that's what my mom would say or stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely a lot of parallels.
David is an only child in the film. Were you also an only child?
No, or? I have a younger brother.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you both sort of shared the brunt of it.
We gave our parents hell.
And what, like, besides the sort of academic pressures, and were you expected to go to college?
Of course, expected to go to Harvard, not college, Harvard. expected to be a surgeon. We had all these aspirations that my parents gave us, and since as kids we kind of don't know what we really want to do, we were like, okay, we'll try it and just kind of go with it. But once I found, you know, like, the taste of acting, and yeah, I just couldn't let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like crack.
Well, how did you find the taste of acting? And how did your parents respond when you told them?
Well, I still haven't really told them, like, I'm going to act for the rest of my life. Like, they just kind of see it through my actions that, okay, this guy, he wants to act, like, you know, for them. But then it's because, like, you never get to, like, tell them, like, you know, just sit down and say, hey, mom and dad, this is kind of what I want to do with my life. I kind of don't have that type of relationship, I guess. It's more like, yeah, like, they always tell me, like, you know, try your best and whatever you do. So this is something that I kind of go by. And I started acting in high school in theater, and it was the most exhilarating feeling in my life. It just kind of gave me wings, you know, like, because when your parents, well, when you have all these pressures as kids, like, you end up doing something completely opposite, or getting into a lot of, like, I guess, trouble. Mm-hmm. And I was a pretty troublesome kid growing up, and almost hated living in a sense. And there was points in my life where I hated, like, joy. I hated happiness. I hated other people even being happy. Mm. It was really like that. I was a really angry kid. However, acting somehow came about. One of my teachers from high school, they told me, his name is Mr. Lee, and he told me, hey, you need to, oh, you want to try acting? And then I was like, not really, because I wasn't really, like, you know, an extrovert. Mm-hmm. So then I was like, I don't know. He's like, yeah, why don't you try it? I think you'll be good. And I was like, okay, sure. And once I tried it, and I was just like, okay, this is pretty fun. I felt alive for once, and I felt like, yeah, I could come out of this small, like, this bubble that I had, like, you know. It just really changed my life. And I felt like I was breathing for the first time and feeling alive for the first time. Mm. Once I got that, I was like, oh, okay, this is a great feeling. I don't know if I should ever go back to it. Is this a career that I could have? I never thought of that at all. I just did it. And then once I got into, like, college, and I was just like, okay, I really love this. I think I'm going to keep doing it.
Did you go to college for acting, or did
no,
you?
Okay. I actually went there.
And did you go to Harvard or no?
No, I did.
Disappointing.
Of course, from the get-go. Yeah. No, I went to UCLA, and then I majored in anthropology with an African American Studies minor.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Wait, why African American Studies?
It's funny, like, people ask me that, but then it's because I truly believe the model minority in America are African Americans. I truly believe it, because from slavery to being a president, that's huge. That's amazing. And I think African Americans have come a long way. I know there's still way more to go, like, way more ways to go. But in terms of gaining power in politics, in terms of really changing, just, like, you know, where they are in society of America, like, I just feel like that's something that all minorities should learn from, or especially Asians should learn from. And I want to kind of, like, use that model to help out the Asian community. That was, like, one of my dreams, to do that, you know?
In what ways do you think like, is there anything in specific that you can take from that that you would apply to?
Solidarity. Like, I feel like there's so much solidarity within the African-American community. And I don't know, just growing up, because I was born in Oakland, I grew up with, like, predominantly African-Americans. And I also grew up in L.A. where there's, you know, a huge African-American population. And that's something that I've always had, like, as my background in a sense. And it's something that I was always interested in. And I was always wondering why, like if you see the news, there's always movements. And it's great to see because just to see a whole community come together to fight for what is right or to even talk about what is right, I think that's huge. I think we definitely need that as Asian Americans because we don't really see that. You know, when there are, it's because our culture is really like, even though there's like maybe hardships that come our way, we need to just overcome by not shouting, by not, it's more, we just have to work harder and go through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So that's kind of like our culture.
Yeah.
And, but I also see the positives in speaking out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating. I feel like especially I'm not from the Bay Area, but I know a lot of people and I've talked to a lot of people who are from the Bay Area. And because that space is so diverse, it makes for people to be a lot more, I feel, enlightened about those sorts of
issues
right? And ideas
yes.
and how they affect other people, not just themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
But LA is also like it's a good, you know, background for that. You
yeah.
know, also.
Well, there's a really nice moment in the film where it's early on where you are speaking, the delivery guy comes and you're speaking in Spanish to him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then you're translating for him, for your parents in Korean. And it's just like a really nice sort of slice of what it can be like to be like in a place that's so bustling with so many different cultures.
Exactly. And especially LA where my soccer teammates, they're all like Latinos, you know, like people in the neighborhood, they're all Latinos. And it's just like you have to learn, you know, like, yeah, you won't get by. You can't order food, you know, you can't order your burritos,
right?
You know, whatever, you know, like it's just you just kind of grow up with it. And I learned it in school and also learned it for church, like when I went to church.
Mm. Now, could you talk a little bit about, I don't want to pry.
No,
but
go for it.
If I'm curious as to whether what you identify as LGBT or if you're straight and also speaking towards like what Korean Americans and what Koreans sort of how they view LGBTQ issues.
Okay. First, like with my whole sexual identity, I kind of want to keep that privately to myself.
Yes.
But in terms of the community, like accepting or not accepting LGBT, I think Koreans and Asians in general, we don't really talk about sex, period. It doesn't have to be LGBT, even straight sex. We don't talk about sex really. Like it's kind of avoided. So that whole subject matter is avoided, let alone LGBTQ like matters are kind of avoided. So it's kind of like, they don't really talk about it.
Mm-hmm. So another aspect of this film is the fact that David is sort of discovering or at least tapping into his own sexuality for the first time.
Yeah.
And Andrew Ahn, the director, he's spoken about how the premise for the film is that he was talking to a friend of his and the friend mentioned that he had like had a great hookup in a spa, in a Korean spa.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized that this place where he goes with his family during the day at night can sometimes turn into these places where men hook up.
Right. Something magical, right?
Yeah. Were you aware of this before you signed on for the movie?
I wasn't aware of it in LA necessarily, but in Korea, people know of it. Like, oh, yeah, that's where, you know, queer people hook up. Or, oh, this is where, like, you know, all the celebrities go to. This is where, you know, like, so people kind of know, like, where, which is what and stuff like that in Korea.
Did you guys do any sort of, and I'm not asking this in a lurid way, but I'm curious, did you, like, go to different spots and talk to different people about it? Or how did you sort of do research, or did you do research?
Oh, Andrew actually did a lot of the research.
Okay.
Him and the producers, Ki-jin, which is, he was the DP of our film. Yeah, they all went around just to see how it really is.
Mm.
And yeah, it's present.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's real. People do talk about it online.
Mm.
And also there are places, even in LA, that's supposedly dedicated to a lot of, you know, gazing and, you know, stuff like that.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. Another thing I want to talk about is the gaze and the gay male gaze, which is different, obviously, I think, from straight male gaze.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to clarify for listeners, your character starts to work at the spa to help make money for his family and doesn't tell his parents because they think he's studying for the SAT.
Right.
And he doesn't want to do that. He wants to help them out.
Right.
And so you start working at the spa and David discovers that the spa is a place for hooking up. And there's lots of just quiet, there's no dialogue in these scenes. It's all about the gaze and the not just the gaze, but also the gaze upon different body parts, but not the body parts that you might usually expect. It's not like the gaze necessarily at the penis or the ass. It's like the gaze at the arms or like the neck.
And that's so true.
Yeah.
You know? Like, yeah, when people do gaze, it's not always about just the penis. It's about everything.
Yeah.
You know, like, it could just be like even like a calf muscle or like, you know, like, yeah, just like maybe his like, you know, Adam's apple or, you know, something like that. Like, there's always something sexy about somebody, like some parts of their body, not always the private parts.
Right. How did you guys go about sort of filming those scenes? And what did you and Andrew and also the other actors sort of talk about in sort of conveying these moments on screen?
Well, a lot of it had to do with Andrew wanting the audience to see David's perspective.
Mm.
And the whole like idea was to be focused on David and how he goes through this whole sexual journey, you know, like it's not only like his first like gay experience, it's like first sexual experience. So I think a lot of people could relate to that.
Mm-hmm. There's also just setting aside the sort of sexual components of David's sort of self-discovery of himself. There's also the aspect of him frequently working out and really he's constantly running and lifting weights and people comment to your friends who haven't seen you in a while. They're like, oh, he's a beast. He's gotten so much bigger.
Right.
And that was another thing that stood out to me because so often when we think of men running and working out and beefing up in movies, it's usually for this, it's because they're playing a sport. They're like a boxer or they're going to be this manly, like very super hyper masculine character.
Right.
But this sort of, it felt more closely to the way women are often perceived because you also see him taking selfies of himself in the bathroom and focusing on his abs and how toned he is. And I'd like to know sort of what you and Andrew discussed in terms of that.
Well, that was all in parallel to David also becoming a man or becoming who he can be who he is. So it's almost those stages where it's like a buildup to the final stage where he goes and releases himself and he sprints.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think the body building was him building into this gay character that he is.
Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned, you talked about how there's a lot you feel the Asian community can learn from the Black community.
Yeah.
And, you know, lately there's been a lot of discussion among relatively well-known Asian actors now, Constance Wu, John Cho. They've all sort of spoken up in a way about the Oscar So White controversy and the limited opportunities for Asian Americans in Hollywood. And I wonder if you feel like as though the Black community within Hollywood has sort of opened the door for now more Asian Americans to come forward and speak up on their own behalf.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we could have ever stepped in front of the camera if it wasn't for like movies like Glory in the past or like anything with Sidney Poitier like back in the day. So yeah, there's all these people that have come before us And it helps a lot. And for the Asian community, finally, for them to actually stand up and say, hey, like, you know, there's these hashtags starring John Cho all over the internet.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. And, like, even in the Oscars, it was just ridiculous. You know, like, those kids, you know.
Oh, right. Just to clarify, that's the Chris Rock bit that he did at the Oscars this year while hosting, where he brought out a bunch of Asian kids. I don't actually remember what the joke was, but I remember being like, come on, Chris Rock.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's...
It seems like it's going to take a lot before... Like, it's already taken a lot for Black people to get to where we are, and we're not even that high up
on
the list.
I know what you mean. But,
and, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see even, like, a Black-Asian collaboration, you know what I mean? That would be awesome. Like, Rush Hour is just the tip of the iceberg, and it's just... Yeah, that's another level of... yeah, I mean, the brunt of the jokes were just, like, you know, stereotypical Asian jokes, but, like, nothing, like, why not do a drama with Asian Black cast, you know? Like, it'll be amazing. I feel like these stories need to be told, and so many people in America who are now, like, living in communities where different races all come to mesh together, they'll relate to it, and they could actually be like, oh, finally, you know, I could see someone less like myself in these films.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel as though this role that you have as David, is this the kind of role that you want to see more of? And is this sort of your first substantial role?
It is like my first substantial one. Even when before I took this film, I was just like amazed that something like this was being made in America. So... I was working out in Asia just because I wanted to be an athlete. I wanted to be a blue collar worker, you know, like something that you'll never see an Asian male be casted for in America. So something when I came back and saw a role like this, I was like, wow, this is amazing. This is like a real story. Like it's like a real role. And there's a lot more other stories to be told. I want to see, like, an Asian Sopranos, you know? Like, the only stuff out there for Asian Americans are, like, comedy. You know, they're all comedy stuff, like Community or, like, you know, Fresh Off the Boat. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but why not have a thriller? Or why not have a drama? Why not have some other genre that we could always do, you know?
Like,
I'm just hoping that this is just the tip of the iceberg, and hopefully a lot more roles will follow.
I feel like when it comes to, like, cinephiles in America and abroad, Asian filmmakers are very much exalted in terms of auteurs and those who are not working in America. Like, are foreign.
Yeah, like Kim Ki-duk, Park Chan-wook.
Right.
Like, these are huge directors all over the world, even in Cannes. He's always invited.
Right.
You know, like, John Woo, like... Oh, my gosh. There's so many.
But then when you think about, you know, Black auteurs, it's like we've got Spike Lee and that's it. and so it's weird because I feel like there are certain areas, and we can go back and forth on this all day, but there are certain areas where, you know, as minorities, Black people in terms of entertainment have gotten more advancements. I mean, we now have more dramas. We're cast in more action films.
Tyler Perry's doing his thing.
Tyler Perry's, he's doing something.
Yeah, he's always doing something.
But then we don't necessarily get the same respect as, you know, foreign Asian auteurs do. And I find it, I mean, it's not a good or a bad thing. I just find it interesting in what white Americans choose to, like, to favor.
I don't even think white America chooses even those exalted directors from Asia, because it's like we're talking about, like, Europe, like Cannes, you know,
true.
Like America is all about, like, encouraging American directors and, you know, like, praising American directors. And for sure, Spike Lee is one of them. Even, like, what's that called? Boys in the Hood. Straight Out of Compton.
Oh, yeah. Gary Gray.
Yeah, exactly.
Ryan Coogler. Ava DuVernay.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're gonna be making greater things, you know, bigger things.
For sure. It would just be nice if there was room at the table for all of us.
No, but there is. I think there, like, this market is huge. It's not just America now. Yeah. Like, whatever America produces, it's going to be watched by, like, the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. We just have that type of power. It's just now, what do we do with this power? Like, let's make diverse films.
So I would like to just have you for my final query. When was the last time you felt as though you saw yourself on screen? Something that was very similar to your own life and that you felt represented on screen?
Yeah, just like Straight Outta Compton was pretty cool. Like, you know, that's because it's in LA and everyone's into hip hop. Like, there isn't too much that I see that I could like, oh yeah, that's so me. The last thing I remember was probably Straight Outta Compton.
Interesting.
Yeah. I know, believe it or not, it's kind of crazy. it's because, like, you know, I will listen to the radio before I sleep, just like really low because so my parents won't hear.
Yeah.
It's just, I kind of could relate to, like, Dr. Dre's love for music, had all his LPs around him. I didn't ever have LPs, but I still remember when I was, like, being taken care of, like, in East Oakland. One of the ladies that helped us out was this black woman. She had her own kids too, but she always looked out for us, and she always played music for us, like Stevie Wonder blasting, you know, like all these old school, like Donny Hathaway and all this old school stuff. And I guess that kind of progressed to me just like trying to like sleep with, like, you know, hip hop music or whatever.
Yeah, that is a truly fascinating, awesome answer. Yeah, that's so cool. It's crazy to me how a movie like Straight Outta Compton can speak to so many different people.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's Straight Outta Compton is sort of the opposite of my entire upbringing.
Oh,
I was not allowed to listen to rap music.
And, yeah. I mean, I wasn't allowed to either.
True.
It's just,
and I
kind of did it in secret.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Joe, for stopping by.
Absolutely,
It was
Aisha.
Great talking with you.
Absolutely, Aisha.
And I hope to see you in a lot more work that is just as good and just as meaty and introspective and thoughtful as Spotlight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
As always, thanks for listening. It was a pleasure to have Alex return to the show and chat transparent with me. And I had a blast with Josa. Spotlight is currently screening at different events and locations over the next few weeks, and you can check to see if it's playing somewhere near you on strandreleasing.com. Subscribe to Represent on iTunes, Megaphone, Stitcher, or any other place you find your podcasts. Represent is produced by the lovely Verilyn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtig. Andy Bowers is chief content officer of Panoply. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Slate Represent. That music you're hearing is performed by the sweet San Francisco funk soul band Midtown Social. Until next time.